full of relativity. And we were allowed to shift our coordinate systems in interesting ways to adapt, well, at a pragmatic level, we do that to adapt the coordinates to solving the physical, so the problem of interest as easily as possible. An example of something that doesn't fit here, and an example where the physical laws would change, would
can I ask you to turn this microphone on?
I guess, oh, I'm on. So an example where that doesn't work is an example in the problem set is if I think about a rotating coordinate system, well, that doesn't fit into, so this is a fixed rotation, but if the rotation is a function of time or constant rotation, things change. Newton's second law acquires some extra terms to fudge the forces. And so that's, well, that's just an example that it's not an arbitrary or an all-encompassing set of rules or transformations. The last one gave us a law for the addition of velocities, but that experimentally ran into problems when we started, or when physicists started thinking about light and things later on moving near the speed of light. So Einstein resolved this problem here, but he did it by making or introducing two new assumptions. The first being what's commonly known as the law of relativity, which is that the laws of physics take the same form in any inertial frame. So our physicists or experimentalists can be moving with respect to each other with a constant velocity, and they'll make the same kinds, or they'll see the same kind of physics. What we're going to have to do, though, is we're going to have to revise this rule for relating the physics in those two frames or in different frames. The other assumption that he introduces is that the speed of light should be thought of as a constant, that it's the same, or it has the same value in all of these inertial frames. And so that clearly fixes this problem here. Just by fiat or by that assumption, I'm always supposed to measure the same C irrespective of the time of year or how I set up the experiment. But this has, well, these two innocuous-looking statements here have very deep consequences. And one of the most profound consequences is that there's no such thing as absolute time. So this idea, well, ultimately we're going to give up on this separation between space and time that I talked about a couple of blackboards ago. But how do I see, or how do I make sense, or no, how do I see this statement here? Is a simple consequence of these assumptions here. Well, I think about a set of observers which can be riding in a very fast train or on a rocket ship here. So we have, what did I call them? Well, I'm not going to draw my stick figures. I'll just say there's an O prime here, there's a B here, and an A here, and they're shooting by this person O, who's sitting at rest in that particular frame. In the frame, or what we can imagine is thinking about just life on the rocket ship, if these two distances are equal, A and B can send signals towards O prime, and in a particular instance, what he can say is, or what he might, what we can imagine is that he receives the signals both from A and from B at exactly the same time. And so he would say that A and B sent those signals or emitted those light signals at precisely the same time. So if O prime I should have said light. At the same time, he or she says, assume so implicitly again I said that the distance between those people was the same, but then if at that instant that O prime is receiving those signals, O looks and he sees indeed O prime received the signals at the same time. He can ask what was or which was emitted first. Because in his frame, those signals are still moving at exactly the same rate as in the rocket ship frame. Namely, he sees the signals traveling at the speed of light. However, the rocket ship is moving. And so if B emits a signal, just because the rocket ship is moving in the direction from O to O prime to B, that signal has less of a distance to travel. Alternatively, when A is sending the signal in the direction that the rocket ship is traveling, to get from the point when he emits the signal to being received at O prime, it's moving more than just this distance because the rocket's moving. And so that signal has to travel farther. And so he would conclude then that if the signals arrived here at precisely the same time, this guy must have emitted the signal first before B, you know, because his signal had to travel further. So it's traveling further because because the motion of the rocket ship carries O prime away from any given position. O prime moves away from A and towards B.
that OC signals that he receives as O prime, or that you're saying that O sees that O prime is receiving the signal?
He's watching what's happening, and he sees that O prime receives a signal.
Okay.
Or he sees this physics, namely that O prime, at a particular instant, perhaps as he's passing here, happens to receive two light signals, one from here, one from here, and they arrive precisely the same time. So there was a lot of words there, was there?
It is assumed that if two events happen at the same time, at the same place for one observer, then it also happens at the same time and the same place for another observer.
Yes. What you're saying is that these two signals, he has two detectors sitting in front of him and they both click at the same time. So this person, when he's watching, sees exactly that. He's watching, this guy happens to be moving across, but he sees the detector also. Both click at the same time.
At that moment, the coordinates of our node prime are set during the detection.
For simplicity, let's say they are. O could have been sitting there watching. There would have been a signal that, the light would have still traveled from here to here. The information it would have carried is that the two needles or the two detectors clicked at the same time because they're both merging from the same place at the same time. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. It's going to be click at the same time to emit the signal. How can A and B?
You're asking how did we synchronize the experiment, which is a good question, but I'm not going to address that yet. We'll get to that in a few moments. All I'm saying is these guys are emitting signals. In one particular case, those signals happen to arrive here at the same time. Yes.
So in this case, whatever is simultaneous for O prime is also happening is also simultaneous for O.
Well, that's the whole point, is that but what we're seeing, this event, the event that both detectors sitting at the same place clicked at the same time, that's something that just happened. When I say simultaneous, maybe I misinterpreted. When we say simultaneous, O prime said that the emission at A and B was simultaneous. Meaning, so these two events that happened at different places happened at the same time.
Sorry, my interpretation is a little different. Is that the signals are arriving at the same time?
Yes.
So O prime sees them arrive at precisely the same instant, and you're saying that O also sees them arrive at precisely the same instant.
Yes.
There's no.
Happens at a point for. There's something that happens that I record, O prime has a position and a time, and there's a certain X and T that I can associate with that event, yes.
So I guess in that case, the emission would not have been simultaneous.
Yeah, that's exactly what we said here. So the point was that because of this assumption here, and the motion of the rocket ship, it's considerable, this will become noticeable. The signal from A had to go further, and so he must have emitted it. He must have emitted the signal before B. And so what was simultaneous,
in one frame, or one inertial frame, is no longer simultaneous in the other frame. And so we have to give up on this idea that I mentioned before, that there's something like an absolute time, that everybody's clocks are running in exactly the same way. So the question is, how can, or what is the rule that's going to replace our Galilean transformation or relate to inertial frames or two frames that are moving at or with a constant velocity with respect to each other? And of course, this is the Lorentz transformation, and for some reason now I've made the velocity in the x direction. But now, as well as including the spatial coordinates, we're going to include time. Where I've defined this gamma 1 over square root of v squared minus c squared. So if I think about a situation where v is much, much less than c, so I'm moving slowly, so I'm in a regime where I might think about classical mechanics, then gamma is essentially 1. And that part of the transformation is just the transformation that we saw before that I called the Galilean transformation. Similarly, this is essentially 1. Here I'm being suppressed by a v over c again. And so essentially the time is invariant. And we can, in the classical frame, think about an absolute time. Yeah.
Is that v sub x then, or v?
No, so that was a v times x.
OK.
Although we're moving in the x direction. So what are some physical consequences that we've got?
Yeah.
Before you move on, in that, I just want to discuss that case a little bit where A and B were sending signals.
Okay.
So instead of light, let's say if they were sending some other wave, sound wave, for example.
Okay.
We would still go through the same logic, right?
Yeah. Or we still go through the same logic. We would, yes. Although,
you know, now what I've got is, I guess, a rocket ship. It's a container. It's got air in it. So that air is moving along with the rocket ship. I made sound waves. I could go through the same logic, and I'd arrive at the same conclusion. But the velocities that I'm talking about would be, well, implicitly, the velocities that I'm talking about would be much less than the speed of light. Otherwise, well, the propagation of the sound wave wouldn't, the sound wave is only going to propagate at some finite velocity with respect to the rocket ship.
There's no wave in the logic that we have
there is.
The difference is, right, that we, to do, in this argument, we assume that the speed of light is the same for all observers.
No, we haven't assumed.
Oh, we haven't?
Yeah.
And we still get lost in the negative.
No, sorry.
No, we have assumed. We have assumed.
If you didn't get baseballs, you would.
That's it.
But you'd realize that they both. You would have simultaneous events.
Yes, we did.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, what was the result? What was your comment?
Okay, so he was asking to point this out, I guess.
So. We did not, in this logic. We did not make this, explicit that the speed of light is being assumed to be a constant for us to arrive at the loss of simultaneity.
Oh, no, we did. Yeah, no, I apologize. You're right.
Yeah, that's a pretty
important thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's what you get for the extra hour. no, that was the key assumption, is that the speed of light was a constant, and that's why. Whereas the speed of sound is, I mean, the sound moving in the medium, which is moving with the rocket ship, well, it's either moving with the rocket ship or the rocket ship's moving to the medium.
I mean, even if we were not to assume the speed of light as a constant here, in one case the time taken will be c plus v by 2, where v is the velocity of, will be proportional to length divided by c plus v over 2. In the other case, it will be length divided by c minus v over 2. There will still be a break in time, I think.
In one way. Let's put the rocket ship here and contain the air. In this frame, I've got Opron A, Z. They're both traveling with the speed of sound. Both of them arrive in a fixed time interval. The speed of sound divided by that length.
So they're moving at the speed of sound within the reference frame A, O prime, B, share.
Right, this is a fixed reference frame. But I've also put the air in the rocket ship. So this is a container now that contains the air. If I'm O and I see everything moving, I see the rocket ship with the air moving. So in this experiment, what I'm seeing is that this moves with respect to V sound, or this travels with a velocity V sound with respect to the rocket ship, and so the velocity there is going that way. I add the velocity of the air to the speed of the sound, whereas here,
Minus
V. So I see this V plus the speed of the rocket ship. Okay.
Yeah.
So, whereas the other signal is moving with the air moving backwards, and so I simply reduce the speed, or I observe that that's moving slowly. Okay, so we straightened that out for me. Are we happy with that?
Well, you want to see this kind of inconsistency.
Yeah.
But Newtonian mechanics is perfectly consistent, so you guarantee it will work. Just do the algebra, it will work. It will be simultaneous.
Oh, you want me to go through the...
the light arrow is just wondering. In the case when they were sending the light signals, if we were not to assume the speed of light were constant.
Mm. Yes, if there was an ether, you mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, would so we resulted in a conclusion that simultaneity was broken. And...
If there was an ether and this was, the rocket ship was moving in the frame of the ether,
right.
I would have just said, the same thing, I would have said light rather than sound.
Yeah, and the same
idea. And that's what Michelson and Morley conjectured, is that they would have used the same set of classical laws and would have come to the same conclusion that it is. So, but we replace our transformation with Lorentz transformation, and we can ask what are the physical consequences.
One simple consequence is that I can see here that y and z are playing no role or not transforming in any interesting way. And so lengths perpendicular to the direction of the velocity remain invariant or unchanged when I go between frames. Another effect is time dilation, or that moving clocks run more slowly, or appear to run more slowly. So a simple example there is if I build my clock with a set of mirrors and I send light signals between the two mirrors, and I set it up, say, well, OK, I could set it up so that this was 30 centimeters, then one length and coming back would be a time interval, say, of 2 nanoseconds. Or there's some fixed time for the light to travel from this mirror up and then back again. On the other hand, if I go to a frame where the clock is moving, because the clock, or because the mirrors are moving now, the light signal travels a larger distance. Again, it's traveling at the same velocity. It's still traveling at the speed c, but it's traveling a larger distance. And that means that the observer, so we'll call him O prime again. O here measures the time interval that's larger than the time interval that was measured on this clock. So when this clock registers 2 nanoseconds, his clock in the rest frame registered a time interval that was longer than that. We can make that more precise. And I will try to do that now. So the is going to be so I'm just applying this part of the transformation law. So this is the interval here. There's a certain, so it involves this passage of time, but also, or a certain passage of time in his frame, but also a passage of space, a delta x. So I write 1 over the square root of 1 over v squared minus c squared. Delta t. What is delta x? Well, it's just the velocity times the time. And so there's another factor of v squared over c squared. which is because of the minus sign. So the time interval that elapsed on his clock was a smaller time interval than elapsed in the rest frame here. And this is actually one of the, well, we'll see in the, well, actually, we'll see in tomorrow's problem set that this was one of the classic tests of special relativity to see the effects of time dilation. Okay, that's two. So here we talked about lengths perpendicular. There's also lengths along the direction of motion. And so the dimensions of a moving object contract along the direct, or appear to contract along the direction of motion. So, well, the simplest way is just to use the Lorentz transformation. And so if I look at some distance, and I ask, what is the corresponding distance with so if I'm in the other frame and I have two observers measuring the distance between the ends of the objects, they make those measurements at the same time and set delta t equals to 0, make the measurement delta x, then we had that delta x prime was equal to gamma delta x, or delta x was equal to square root of 1 minus d squared over c squared, the distance of the original object, or the distance measured of the object in its original rest frame.
Is there a question there?
We were just trying to calculate the times for the sound case.
Okay.
For some reason, we were not getting the same time. Like you said initially, when your thought was that you would go through the same logic and you observe a break in some energy, we were observing something similar. So just trying to sort that out.
Well, can I suggest? Well, okay. Can I suggest that we maybe revisit that in the tutorial this afternoon?
Yeah.
Here was
Well, the idea, we can look at the Lorentz transformation law, and we can see that, well, the specific, or make clearer the idea that there is no absolute time. Well, it goes by the title of synchronization. What I described here was I had an object, some pole of some length, that in its rest frame had a length delta x prime. In the rest frame, two observers with at the same moment measured that length and called it delta x. But one might assume that there's some kind of a contradiction here, but the contradiction's resolved in that in the original rest frame, where that was a length delta x or a longer length, the thing is that these measurements that these two people are making are not being made at precisely the same time, or there is a delta t prime between the times of those measurements. And you can just use the Lorentz transformation law. You know, what we said here is that the observers, or the measurements were made at a distance, a separation delta x, but we set delta t 0. And so what the observer on the, or moving with the pole would say, is that the measurements were made at different times, and that's why they came up with this shorter distance. So the two measurements were made with a separation in time of minus gamma v over c squared delta x. And the point being, because they were made at different times, the pole moved, or the object moved, and that's why they came up with a different distance than the one measured in the rest frame. One of what was to be an exercise was the idea, well, maybe we can just do it at the board. We'll see. The Galilean transformation law gave us a simple transformation or addition law for velocities, how the velocity in one frame compared to the velocity in another frame. And what we can do is we can simply look to see what is the addition law for velocities. As I move between two frames. So let's say that in a given frame, I measure a velocity of a particle, so it's a certain dx over a dt, and there's some numbers. If I measure, or I try and measure the same velocity in the moving frame, I'm just going to put primes everywhere. But I have primes everywhere. What I have, or what the Lorentz transformation law gives me, is the rule for how delta x and delta t here compare to the delta x and the delta t in the previous case. And so I can write out that, for instance, vx prime is dx prime over dt prime. But this was going to be given by dx minus v dt. There was a gamma. So that's just the Lorentz transformation law of dx prime. There's also a gamma dt minus v vx or dx over c squared. The gammas cancel out. I divide those two by the dt's, and what I end up with is a vx minus a v in the numerator, and a 1 minus v vx over c squared in the denominator. Similarly, I can go through and look at the other components in the same way. Here I'm going to have a dy prime over a dt prime. In this case, this one is trivial, and so the gamma doesn't go away. And so there's a 1 over, well, there's a 1 over a gamma, which gives us a square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. Again, that v is the velocity that takes us from one frame to the other frame. And then I have a vy in the numerator, and I have the same denominator, vx over c squared, because that part was the same. And similarly, I'm going to get the same equation over here with y, with that y index going to a z index. And so, well, the addition law for velocities is somewhat more complicated than it was before. One of the things that one can verify is that if I happen to be measuring something, or a light signal here, if I was measuring something moving at the speed of light in the initial frame, what I'll find is that that speed is still the speed of light in the moving frame, or in the other inertial frame. So we can use this, or what we find then is that our Lorentz transformations are consistent with this simple postulate here. If we have C in one frame, then we have C in another frame. We can also if I start with a velocity in one frame where an object's moving at less than the speed of light, then I'll find that in the second frame, that the object's, irrespective of how we transform or what direction we transform in with respect to this initial velocity vector, that if we had v less than the speed of light, then v prime is still less than the speed of light in the second inertial frame. These are exercises that we'll see, I guess we'll see them next day. Another exercise that I'll ask you to look at is to think about acceleration. In this case, I can go through a similar exercise for an acceleration, but we would find it's sometimes said that acceleration is absolute. What that means is that if I'm thinking about an object moving with a constant velocity here, I can always, using our transformation law, choose a v or I can do a Lorentz transformation that puts us in a in that particular particle's frame where the v prime is equal to zero. On the other hand, when I'm thinking about acceleration, if I have an object that's accelerating or the second derivative is non-vanishing, through a Lorentz transformation, I'll never be able to set that acceleration to zero. So the, if one observer sees the particle accelerating, then all observers in inertial frames will see that same particle accelerating.
I can understand that if I see a particle that is not accelerating, then anybody who I see moving with constant velocity could also see the particle not accelerating. But this
are
is
you
a, like
common sense.
Right. Well, but like, so let's say both of us are actually accelerating, right? I see observer A accelerating and I see observer B accelerating with the same, you know, acceleration profile. So they should both, like in their reference frames, right, everything, they both believe they're inertial. Or they both, each one believes the other is inertial. So they should have both also. Or does that make any sense?
I think what you're saying is that there are more interesting thought experiments than one that one can do rather than just sticking to inertial frames.
Well, I guess I'm wondering sort of what's the definition of an inertial frame? Can you pick out an absolute inertial frame, or do you have to say I'm inertial relative to somebody else?
Well, this will become an interesting story once we include general relativity and the space-time becomes curved. In special relativity, well, I'll use the word, the space-time is flat. I guess by definition, in setting up the space-time, I've assumed that that the physics we're studying we assume that the physics we're studying is physics in inertial frames, and given whatever our starting point is, we can use Lorentz transformation to describe like any other inertial frame. As always, that's an approximation. I mean, we use this kind of physics to describe the physics of particles moving around in accelerators at nearly the speed of light. On the other hand, it's true that in principle, that accelerator is accelerating because of the gravitational field of the Earth, the motion of the Earth around the Sun. All of those things, but again, it's an approximation that's very valid, that seems to be valid, it is valid that those accelerations are negligible compared to the kind of kinematics or the physics that we're interested in for those, for that particular physical situation. That didn't seem to make me happy at all.
Sorry, I think it made it because I was missing the part. So he mentioned that you can measure whether or not you're in an inertial frame by looking at the paths of light rays, and if they're straight, you're in an inertial frame, and if they're not straight, you're not. Does that test always work? That's the kind of thing I'm looking for. What's a criterion for deciding whether or not you're in an inertial frame?
That would be a useful criterion. And for example, in the experiment that I'm talking about, even though If a light ray crossed, say, the LHC, the ring of the LHC, in principle, we know that it's actually going to be deflected in the mirror. But that would be such a negligible effect compared to the kind of physics that we're interested in that we would discard it and say that it is.
Can I just say something about that? So, NEMA went through about how accelerated observers measure temperature. So, you need a thermometer that would.
You're saying that if you measure the unknown effect, that means you're accelerating.
That's what NEMA
shows,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that allowed?
But it's a small effect, isn't it?
It's a small effect.
It's a
The reason I'm smiling is in the pristine framework in which we're discussing here, in principle, yeah, we do measure that. As a practical thing, though, I mean, everything in this room is radiating a much higher temperature.
I think you want to do it in principle, and
yeah.
Okay. So you yeah. Space time is still an absolute thing, so.
Right.
I think you can accelerate in that somehow. Yeah.
Well, okay, I'll try and draw some pictures in the last 5 minutes. So, the pictures I want to draw are just
if we're thinking about observers or experiments. And just a useful way to picture what's going on or how to relate frames is to use as a graphical tool a Minkowski or Minkowski space or a space-time diagram. So what we have, well, what we typically do in contrast to classical physics, because it's relativistic physics, we turn the diagram on its side, the spatial directions go horizontally now, time runs upward. But to put things on the same diagram to make the units work out, I need a conversion constant, and of course, special relativity gives us a handy converging constant to turn time into, to make that axis turn it into a spatial direction or spatial. To make the displacements here spatial, if I multiply by the speed of light times time, then this can be measured in inches or meters or whatever, the same set of units that I'm using on the horizontal axes. And of course, I'm going to suppress my y and my z. Just because my artistic abilities are somewhat limited. If I'm thinking about a person moving, I would draw his world line or the path, the sequence of points that he visits with time. If I think about an event, such as two signals reaching my observer at a given time, that would be given just by, or that would be a point. And so a place where we see points, a place where we see points is, for instance, when world lines cross. And so where those world lines cross is just some point on the diagram. So this might be the path of 4. Signal. And this, a point would be an event or something of interest happening, such as two world lines crossing. If I use my Lorentz transformation, and now I'm writing them with CTs just for convenience of the graph. I can draw my diagram again, and I can relate two different frames. So if this was CT and this was X, If I ask what is a line of, say, constant t, so in this diagram, a line of, or rather a line of, what's a line of constant t prime? In this diagram, lines of constant t were horizontal lines. Here, a line of constant t prime is going to be a line at a certain slope given by this ratio, v over c. And so, for instance, if I draw the line ct prime equals 0, it might be a line like that. If I then draw subsequent lines, so these are ct prime equals constant. So the here again, t equals a constant were horizontal lines, and so simultaneous events, so these two points, these two events would have been simultaneous in the original frame. Events, those events, though, would not be simultaneous in the second frame because they're not lying on the same line now of constant t prime. Similarly, if I put two points on the same line of ct prime, clearly in the original frame, those aren't lying on a horizontal line anymore, and so they're not simultaneous either. And so that's, well, that's illustrating this idea that the points, or that we've given up on absolute time, that in different frames, simultaneity means different things. Similarly, if I want to ask what's a constant x prime, I've also got a line at some constant slope. So x equals 0 might be a line like this. If I choose other, lines of constant t, or x prime, I'll get an array. Of points like that. So here, if this was x prime equals 0, I can think of this as the ct prime axis. And similarly, if this was t prime equals 0, I can think of this as the x prime axis. And so what we see is that going from one frame to another, we've sort of squashed the grid, or the natural grid that appeared, or was implicit here, turns into this diamond-shaped grid in the other frame, or the other frame that lines that other grid. And so, well, the comment was that this immediately illustrated this idea that things that are simultaneous in one frame weren't simultaneous in the other frame. And I think I really have to call it quits there for today, but we'll carry on from there and continue our review of special relativity tomorrow morning, unless there are any questions.
Okay, if not, I'll
see you this afternoon, I guess.